I want to take a few minutes and just kind of explore an issue. You see, I was thinking about this a lot, that I think part of the reason that we live in such an anxious age, and the reason that Christians are so anxious in this time, is because we've forgotten the strangeness, the weirdness of Christianity. We've forgotten just how different we are called to be and how different God is. And when we forget that, it's easy just to get wrapped in to another thing and to think of this as just another collection of people, just another social organization where we have fun, we sing some music, we do some service events, and we forget how different everything is, how different we're called to be. See, it's kind of, and I was thinking about that. I was reading this book, James K.A. Smith, On the Road with St. Augustine. And Smith is one of those guys who is just flat out brilliant. He is just working at this level way up here. But he is such a good writer that even somebody like me can understand this. And I'm like, oh, this reads nice. I like this. And you see, he's writing this book about Augustine, and I don't know about as much as about Augustine as I should, because he is one of those incredibly important people. He might be the most important Christian theologian. Without Augustine, you do not have Aquinas or Martin Luther. And Augustine was writing about 1,600 years ago, and he had a Let me tell you this. In his youth, he was not an ideal child. The story Augustine tells himself is that he wanted some pears, and so he had money to buy pears, and he even had good pears himself, but he's like, you know what would taste even better than these pears I have here? Stolen pears, okay? And that's the kind of thing you would do. You're just like, I'm going to steal those because they taste better when I've stolen them. And he did a lot of things as a young adult and as an adult, which I'm not even going to talk about in church because I'm trying to keep the sermon PG. I will let you look it up. It's all on Wikipedia and other places. But he was a fascinating guy, because he did a lot of things which we all can empathize with us that are not on the right side of morals and ethics as a young person or an adult. But then God gets a hold of him, and he becomes this amazing figure. And part of the reason I bring him up today is because he's writing there about 1,600 years ago in this environment when the question of competing worldviews, Christianity versus paganism, different ethical systems, and all this ferment and unrest and everything else is happening. And you can't help but read about the circumstances 1,600 years ago and think, gosh, it kind of sounds like today. Different competing world systems, unrest, ferment, anxiety, everything else. And you can say, I don't want to live in that world. You can say, I want there to only be one worldview, and I want everything to be stable, and it should be. But friends, I want the Vikings to win the Super Bowl, and that ain't going to happen this year either, okay? I'm really praying the Packers don't win, because y'all are going to be insufferable. It is my cross to bear. But I tell you all this because we have a lot to learn from Augustine and others who've gone before us. Smith writes this about Augustine. Augustine might make Christianity believable for you even if you've heard it all, been there, done that, and left the stupid Christian t-shirt at home. Here's a Christianity to consider before you stop believing. Augustine might make Christianity plausible again for those who've been burned, for those who suspect Christianity they've seen is just a cover for power plays and self-interest, or a tired moralism that seems angry all the time, or a version of middle-class comfort too often confused with the so-called American dream. If the only faith that you can imagine is the faith of your parents, Augustine has been down that road. What if precisely the strangeness of his ancient struggles that made Augustine perennial, someone with distance from our own immersion to give us a vantage point to seeing for ourselves and the Christian faith anew? And I share that with you because I love what Smith writes, that it's when we look through these people who have been through these struggles before and have seen our faith lived out, it lets us see our faith fresh. Now, I want to take a look at one of a very comforting book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. I was curious to see if I get a reaction on that one. Okay. The book of Revelation was written, actually, let me start here. Put up that first slide, please. This is the key for understanding the book of Revelation. John to the seven churches that are in Asia. See, what happens, there's this guy by the name of John. He's on this island of Patmos, which is just off the coast of Greece. And God gives him this vision and says, here, I want you to send it to these seven churches in Asia, what we would call modern-day Turkey. And what's going on is this is a time towards the end of the first century when the Christian church is being persecuted. And so the book of Revelation is this vision that John has, that God gives him and says, I want you to share it with these churches so they can understand what's going on. So in the midst of the persecution, in the midst of the trial, in the midst of the trouble, and they're hanging on by the fingernails, God says, here's what you need to know. And one of the things that confuses us is we forget this part, that it's for these seven churches in Asia 2,000 years ago. And so the symbology, the language that gets used, we have trouble understanding it. And I cannot tell you how many times people have gone down this rabbit holes of trying to parse out these things of, well, this means this, and Gog and Magog symbolize this, and these stars symbolize that. And it's like, oh, you people are missing the main points. Okay? It is written for us to have encouragement in time of trial, when you're hanging on by your fingernails. Go ahead and put up that next slide. I want to show you, we're going to spend a little bit of time here. This is Revelation chapter 7. This might be probably my top five favorite passages of the whole Bible. Okay, not just Revelation, but this whole Bible. I love this passage. And I'm just going to read a big chunk of it here. The beginning of chapter 7. After this, I saw, John's getting this vision, and he's bouncing back and forth between heaven and earth and heaven and earth and sliding around in time. So it's very hard to make a timeline to this. But this is the vision that God's giving him to pass on to these churches. And so this is what he sees. I saw the four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the earth or sea or against any tree. And then I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal of the living God. And he called with a loud voice the four angels who had been given power to harm earth and sea, saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And then I heard the number of their sealed, 144,000 from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And he goes on to list 12,000 from the tribe of Judah, Reuben, Gad. I'm not going to read them all. But he's saying, okay, it's this number of perfection. 12, which is this very biblical number, symbolizes a lot of things. And it's 12 times the 12 tribes, number of perfection, 144,000, okay? That's what he hears. But then what happens, he says, after this I looked, and behold, a great multitude no one could number from every nation, all the tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne of the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, crying out, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And it is this beautiful passage, and it is this image of every tribe, people, language, standing before the throne. These are all the people who've gone before who have followed Jesus. And so I want you to think, how does that passage hit? in a time like Augustine, in a time like the first early church, when they're being persecuted and they're hanging on by their fingernails, and then you get this beautiful vision of heaven. And how does it hit for us when we feel like we're hanging on and so trapped in a time and a place? Let me tell you a story. Going back a ways, this is one of those stories that's rattled around in my head for a long time. About the year 300, so slightly before Augustine, slightly after John, there's this little town in what today is Turkey called Sebaste. And in this time, Christianity has been growing and growing and growing. And what happens is there's persecution of the church. And the persecution doesn't happen constantly. It happens, and then it goes off for a while, and then it happens, and it goes off for a while. And it just kind of comes and goes in waves, depending on the politics of the empire and who's in charge and how things are going. So there hasn't been persecution, and then there is persecution. And the Romans had this way of handling when they wanted to persecute Christians. And what they would do is if somebody accused you of being a Christian, they wouldn't come to you in the middle of the night and pound on your door like the East German secret police in the 60s. It's not what they would do. What they would do is they would show up and say, hey, somebody's accused you of being a Christian. Are you a Christian? And if you said no, they said, great, let's go down to the temple. You make a sacrifice to our pagan gods. Boom, you're done. Go home. No harm, no foul. But if you said, yes, I'm a Christian, then they'd say, okay, well, that's a problem. We need you to either recant and disavow your faith or die. One of those two. Which is it going to be? And so in this little town of Sebaste, there was 40 guys who had been part of the Roman army. And they said to these 40 guys, what's your choice? Are you going to die or are you going to renounce your faith in Jesus? And these 40 guys are like, we're going to hang on to Jesus. And so they say to them all, okay, we're going to put you on this frozen lake. And those of us here in Wisconsin know how cold frozen lakes can be. And they say, you're going to stand on this frozen lake until you do one of those other, disavow Jesus or die. Your choice. And so they're out in the frozen lake. And one of those 40 says, you know what? I've had enough of this. I'm done. And so he disavows Jesus, and he goes and he stands by the campfire that the Romans had conveniently set to let people warm themselves up. And those 39 who are left there stay standing on that frozen lake. Until one of the Roman guards sets down his weapons and goes to join the other 39. And that 39 becomes 40 again. And it's a powerful message that echoes down for us today. Because they weren't screaming, they weren't cursing, they weren't fighting. They were bearing witness to this profound strangeness and this promise of God. This vision that John has and says, yeah, you might not win in this world. It might seem unsettled and crazy and weird and wild in this world, but there is this promise of God for you. And friends, that's what I want us to focus on. Because part of the reason I think we get so wrapped up and so wild and so angry about the stuff that's happening now is we lose sight of eternity. We lose sight of what's happening in heaven. And that's part of what All Saints is about. How this has been handed down from generation to generation to generation. One of the things that we traditionally do at All Saints is we light a candle for those people who have been saints in our lives. And when we say saint, we're not saying somebody who does good works. We're not saying somebody who has done all this perfect stuff. But we're saying a saint is somebody who is a follower of Jesus. And so when we light those candles, what we're doing is we're thanking God for those people who've gone ahead of us and shared Jesus with us. It's funny, I was thinking about that this week, and there was a guy I worked for back in the day. I spent a summer working for him up in northern Minnesota. His name was John Hoganson. We're up in Grand Marais, North Shore of Lake Superior, one of the most beautiful places on earth. And I learned so much from him, not just about faith, but about how to live as a pastor, how faith plays out, and how to lead as a Christian. And it was funny because I was just saying to Lorianne a couple of days ago that I only worked for him for 3 months, but the lessons I learned from him are just totally out of proportion, because there is just a lot of stuff that he taught me that I still think about all these decades later. And it's just kind of amazing. And I want to ask you that in your life. Who are the people in your life who have been those saints, who have shared who Jesus is, who has shaped your faith? Now, here's the question for you. A lot of times when we do this kind of a thing, All Saints Day thing, we stop there. But we're not called to stop there. We're called to continue to share that faith with the people after us. We're continued to reflect God's love for the people after us. Let me give you this illustration. And this might sound like a dig at first, and it is the opposite of that. There is a huge difference between church and Rotary. And I say that because I pick Rotary because I have immense respect for them. They're a great social organization, a great service organization. I was part of Rotary for a couple of years when we lived down in Texas. And if you know any of their history of how they helped save lives in Africa against smallpox, you could not help but have just immense respect for them. But I think sometimes we get confused, and we think we're just another social service organization where people get together, we do good things, we fellowship together, and we have a good time together. And we don't recognize the profound strangeness of this faith that has been passed down for 2 millennia. And we are called to be changed by the power of the Holy Spirit. We gather here and we worship together, recognizing that the Holy Spirit is working in our lives. We choose this day to do First Communion, to do a baptism, because it's a recognition that it doesn't end with us. And what I want you to do as you go and you light a candle is to remember that person who's gone before you, who shared their faith with you, but then to ask God, how are you calling me? How are you filling me with your Spirit? How are you changing me so that I can share that faith with the next generation? How can I share that? And how can I be who you have called me to be? So what we're going to do now is I'm going to invite you back, as you feel led, to just take a minute and to light that candle for whoever has shared that faith, and then to pray that God would be at work in your life.